Hi, folks. Mark Scroggins back with another edition of Family Law Talk, and here with our guest, Cindy Hyde again. Hi, Cindy. How are you?
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I am good. So we are going to talk today about, well, first of all, why don't you explain a little bit about your background, and then people will understand where we're going with a lot of this.
Okay. Yep. So I am a psychotherapist and relational trauma expert. And I also have a specialization in certified sex addiction, as well as partner betrayal. I also do complex trauma and some other things that go along with that.
So thank you very much. So this is an area that in my practice, I see more and more. I think, I'm trying to think, probably the first case, I think I probably had my first case that had a sex addiction component 18 or 20 years ago. And then about 10 years ago, it really, I don't want to say took off, but I guess that would be an accurate way of portraying it. It's become much more at the forefront. And it seems to me, you know, so it is now becoming more and more of a piece of different cases, just like, you know, drugs and alcohol are involved in a huge amount of cases. And so where you still have people with drugs and alcohol that will think addiction is, you know, it's a moral issue. It's a, you've got no willpower, total bullshit,
right.
You know, but I think this one, it, I think it's hard for people to understand certain things, being addicted to the things that are just part of normal human nature. And so I want to talk about some of this a little bit so we can try to, you know, take some of the shame away from it. And, you know, so anybody who's actually having a problem with this knows to, you know, call Cindy or call somebody that is, has got that same kind of expertise to get the help. And because there is help out there. I remember when I was helping a client, probably, I guess it was that first one, 18 or 20, you know what? It's got to be 20 years ago. Good Lord, Mark. Okay. I'm getting old as hell.
Time flies.
I'm telling you. But I remember when, you know, if somebody would have come to me and needed to go to a treatment center for drugs or alcohol, I could help you out with that.
Right.
Okay. But back then, I mean, somebody that really specialized, it was kind of bare bones here. I if I recall, I think he went out to the Boulders in Arizona.
Correct. Yeah. Boulders, Meadows, all of those are pretty popular now for sex addiction.
Yeah. And now we've even got, you know, Meadows piece right here,
you
just up the street,
yes,
you know,
you
what,
right here
Frankfurt
in
and Preston. Yeah. So, or that area anyway. So we hear about sex addiction. Mm-hmm. We hear about love addiction, and with love addiction, you've got the love avoidant and what
and is the love addict,
the love addict. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk briefly here about, can you explain to folks really kind of what sex addiction is? Because I think everybody thinks of he or she has a high libido or a low libido, and it's just, you know, he's just a horny old man kind of thing, you know? And so how do we know when it's crossing over into a real addiction area?
Yeah. And you know, men get the bad rap on sex addiction because it can apply to women too.
Right.
And as we talked about in our last episode, you know, sex addiction really wasn't called sex addiction for many years because it really wasn't even recognized and still isn't recognized by the DSM, which is the book that therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists use to diagnose. And but Dr. Patrick Carnes actually started the movement and realized that it was like any other addiction. It was something that people couldn't stop on their own and acting out behavior. So, for instance, like, yes, they may have had high libido, but at the same time, they were doing behaviors like, you know, watching porn all day at work while they were being paid to work, or they were, you know, married and acting out with multiple partners outside the relationship. And so he realized that the people that were doing these types of behaviors could not stop on their own, which is addiction 101, right? Because you know, any addiction, if you can't stop it on your own, you are very likely in addiction. And so what Patrick says is if you can't stop it for 6 solid months by yourself, then you very likely are in addictive behavior. And so it's no different. It's, you know, it's whether it's sex or food or whatever. And like to your point, you said that, you know, sex is a part of life, right? Because we're human beings designed for sex, right? But at the same time, so is food, right? But there are people that have very legitimate food addictions and they can't stop binge eating on their own.
Right.
So if you look at it from that perspective, you know, the sex addiction is the same thing. It could be binging or purging that they cannot stop on their own. So they could be binge sexing, but they could also be purging and anorexia. That's called actually called sexual anorexia, and that too is an addictive behavior.
Explain that to me. I'm sorry, I'm not quite grasping
that.
So
it means where, you know, they just abstain from sex for long periods of time, and they cannot, you know, make themselves become sexual beings. And so Patrick actually kind of realized that dynamic too. And sometimes a sex addict will be very sexual outside his monogamous relationship with a wife or a partner,
right,
but be anorexic within their relationship because he or she is getting all of their needs met sexually outside the relationship.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, we hadn't talked about this before, but I've got my own question about this. How much do you think religion can play a part in this? And where I'm coming from, obviously, is the restrictive nature. Because it seems like the U.S. in particular, and there are plenty of other religions, I mean, so I always think of fundamental Christians, and then, you know, you can see a lot of it in the Muslim world and things like that of, you know, it's only there for procreation and it's a bad thing, you know, it's not like supposed to be something that's enjoyed and fun. It's just, you know, procreation. Mm-hmm. 'Cause, you know, you go over to Europe and it's a totally different attitude towards sex in general, you know.
And, you know, that you've got a point there. And I think, too, that, you know, people have their own preferences about whether they want those, you know, their faith to be a driving factor in their sexuality or not. However, that said, what Pia Melody says, and she's the one that has also a pioneer in a lot of these areas, but what she says is that children, when they are brought up in a very rigid environment or a dictator type environment, they'll either go to a good and perfect role or they'll go to a bad and rebellious role. And so if in fact that is true, which I believe that it is, you know, somebody that comes out of a very strict, stringent environment, no matter whether it's sex or alcohol or drugs, they could go to that bad and rebellious role and act out sexually or drink, you know, excessively or do drugs just simply because they were never shown balance. They were never allowed to have balance or like you said, they've seen sex as taboo or bad their whole life. And so therefore they, you know, will act out because it's kind of like if you were to deprive, you know, think about it. Every time you go on a diet, right?
Right.
The first thing you're going to do is binge before the diet starts, right?
Absolutely.
And it's kind of the same thing. So when you tell somebody they can't do something,
right,
the first thing they're going to want to do is that thing,
right?
So you're, to your point, yeah, in some religious cultures, they make it where it seems so bad that, it's the first thing they're going to do. So, like, if, you know, my father, for instance, was a non-drinker when I was growing up.
Right.
His mother was an alcoholic. So he, you know, alcohol was bad in when I was growing up.
Right.
And so guess what? As soon as I could get my hands on it, that's the first thing I did.
Right.
And so now, you know, I thankfully never had a problem with it, but I could have.
Sure.
And so I think it's the same thing for any addiction.
Okay. It is something that came to mind because you always hear about, you know, the preacher's kid, right? Mm-hmm. Who's always the wild child and all of that. So.
And I think you see it too going the other way, not just with sexual addiction, but with sexual anorexia.
Right.
And so because, and particularly, I think we see this more in women who, because they're raised to think sex is bad, that then they're more anorexic in their relationships because they're afraid or they think they're doing something bad.
Okay. Can you differentiate for me the difference between sex addiction and love addiction? I know we talked about you know, sex addiction a little bit more before, and we didn't really get over there the last time.
And so what love addiction is, there, it kind of, it Love addiction is where someone gets really into fantasy about who their partner is very, very quickly. And when the partner starts pulling away, then their anxiety or their anxiousness goes to high octane. And they'll end up they're actually creating the one thing they don't want, which is they're pushing their partner away.
Right.
So a lot of times love addiction and sex addiction can go together because mm-hmm. a lot of love addicts will have a lot of sex trying to keep their partners. Or what they'll do when they feel the partner pulling away too much is they'll go act out sexually with someone else because they can't feel the pain of the love avoidant or their partner pulling away from them. So they'll end up being the one that cheats, even though that was really the last thing they wanted and they really wanted to stay in the relationship with the partner, but the partner was pulling away.
Okay.
And so that's how it kind of gets entangled. And so there actually is an anonymous program called Sex and Love Addiction Anonymous, because oftentimes it's together.
Okay. And you just mentioned love avoidant.
Mm-hmm,
so can you talk a little bit more about that and kind of mm-hmm. how that dance plays out between yep. the love addict and the love avoidant?
And so, yeah, I saw an article written about it that I thought was pretty funny. But so they named the love addict, and I'm going to make the love addict female and the love avoidant male just for the purposes of this conversation. But
sure.
they called the love addict the crazy in love one. And then they called the love avoidant, give me some room to breathe.
Right.
And so what happens, it all stems in childhood where the love addict did not get her needs of nurturing or love in her relationship with her parents. And so maybe the parents were too busy and they were working or they were gone all the time or they just dismissed the child a lot. And so that child will grow up just craving love and attention. And so, and then the same thing with the love avoidant. The love avoidant grew up having to caretake. He may have had to have been the parent in his family. And so because of that, what happens is they grow up feeling like they have to caretake everybody. So when the love addict comes in and they're super needy, it just pushes them away and they start feeling enmeshed or engulfed. And so for them, if they feel engulfment, they're going to pull away. But yet if the love addict starts to pull away from them because they feel them pulling away, then the love avoidant will start feeling abandoned and they'll lean back into the love addict. So it truly is this dance.
Right.
It's this vicious cycle. And what they both really want is a loving connection, but they really both have a big fear of intimacy. And so the love addict, her biggest fear is rejection and abandonment. So the second she feels that love avoidant pull away, it triggers her fear of abandonment, and all of a sudden her intensity goes through the roof of her trying to keep that person in her life. And then if the love avoidant still continues to pull back, then she'll end up acting out. Either she'll start looking for a new partner pretty quick to try to fill that void of what she feels like she's losing with the love avoidant partner.
So a couple of questions that come to mind on this. You mentioned about, all of this stems, as so much of it does, from our childhood.
Absolutely.
So is there a general time frame age-wise that will tend to trigger this, or where you're observing certain behavior during a time frame?
And most of the time what I see is it happens anywhere from 5 to like 15 or 16, because when they're the smallest child around age 5 years old, that's when they're daddy, 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 or mama, 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 right? And if the mom and dad aren't answering that call, then the child feels neglected, and they may not even consciously know that's what they feel, but that's what they feel.
Right.
And so they'll start looking to other things to get their needs met. Maybe they start soothing with food really early in life, or, they just start learning to be really isolated and independent. But what they're really craving is love from the parent and nurturing from the parent. And if the parent dismisses when they need nurturing, that just adds to it. And so then with the love avoidant, it's kind of the complete opposite, that they're almost getting too much attention from the parent, and the parent is actually relying on the child to be the parent to them. So they may unload all of their stuff on this 5 or 6 year old child and expect the child to fix that emotionally for them. So yeah, you know, but, and it also, I see it a lot in the teenage years too, like from 13 to 16. And I think a lot of that has to do with junior high and middle school, because kids are trying so hard to fit in, you know, to friend groups and to belong. And so what will happen is that, they won't fit in anywhere, and they'll start just losing their identity, and they never really gain it back before they start getting into relationships. And so they're looking for love even in those years, or running from love even in those years. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, I had another fantastic question, but it just went by the wayside. Now I can't remember what I was going to ask you.
That's okay.
So at, you talked about with sex addiction that, you know, it's a continuing acting out when you don't want to. I mean, that's kind of the classic thing with, you know, drugs or alcohol. You know, you're taking a drink because you feel that you have to have it. You don't have a choice in the matter. So generally, these are going to be in drugs and alcohol. You know, you're going to have typically some pretty significant consequences. You know, there's going to be a bottoming out, so to speak. Do you have that same kind of thing typically in the sex addiction or love addiction?
Yeah, there's tons of divorces and breakups, and there's lots of sexually transmitted diseases passed along, and you know, a lot of broken hearts and hurt people. Because a sex and a love addict, their addiction is to people. It's not necessarily, I mean, like an alcohol, a drug or food are all substances, right? But a sex and love addict, or just a sex addict or just a love addict, their addiction is to people. And then of course the sex addict is to the gratification and the impulse. But, you know, it's interesting how, you know, our society really doesn't see sex addiction as a thing, but yet, like, when you look at how much, just let's just say porn alone is available out there, it's billions and billions of dollars worth of information that is being utilized on a daily basis.
Right.
And a lot of times it starts there in young people, both boys and girls, they're exposed to it at a very young age, and then they can't stop. But, you know, by the time they're in adulthood, and it's destroying their relationships.
Right.
And I had a client not long ago that, you know, she kept feeling like something was wrong. The partner was anorexic in the relationship, and come to find out, her partner was just, you know, binge watching porn all the time. So then he couldn't, you know, have sex in a normal relationship with her. And so, you know, it's a much bigger thing than what most people realize.
Okay. Well, we're going to come back here in just a minute. I want to continue down this road, though, looking at, you know, what are the red flags that people should be looking for, either to self-diagnose or if they're concerned that their partner has a problem, what should they be looking at? And then I want to talk about, you know, what's out there as far as help. Okay. All right, folks. Thanks. We'll be back.
Okay. So let me make notes about that.
God, I can't remember what the hell that other question was I was going to ask you. Do you see in the love and sex addiction? So obviously, not only do you have broken marriages and stuff like that with drugs and alcohol, but, you know, you have lost jobs and things of that sort.
Absolutely.
Do you see that kind of thing happening to a large extent, or really?
Yeah, actually, and the interesting part is, and let me think if I can think of the categories. So the top 5 categories for sex addiction are pastors, attorneys, men in uniform, I need to write these down, men in uniform, pilots, pastors, attorneys, men in uniform, pilots, and there's one more, doctors.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Men in uniform, pilots, doctors.
Yep.
Now.
And I had actually an attorney that was a client that had lost his job due to his acting out behavior.
So I'm sorry, pastors, attorneys, men in uniform, doctors, and what was the other?
Pilots.
Is
this like a specific
and not age? Necessarily in that order, but
sure.
But yeah, it can start as young as 13 years old. You know, a 13-year-old can get addicted to porn and
right.
And out of the pastors and the men in uniform, and the is it because they are like shamed, or is it because it is something that is this primarily
U.S.? Well, and I don't know if it has anything to do with it, but those are all power positions, right? And so a lot of sexual acting out is about the conqueror, about the conquest, about the hunt. And so, and it's about power.
Right.
And so all of those are power careers. And so, yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. It's funny because it seems like attorneys and doctors are always with any kind of addiction deal are top two.
Yep. And alcohol is a big one for them too.
Yeah.
And, right.
Well, it would seem to me, you know, we joke around that the hardest people to represent are doctors, lawyers, and pilots because they've all got God complex.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know? Either the God complex or the power complex. You know, because sex addiction is truly about power.
Right.
And so, yeah, that it lines up.
Yeah. Okay.
Monogamous partner
can be an indicator that they're acting out sexually somewhere else, actually.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Guilt, maybe?
No, it's because they get caught up in the fantasy of the acting out behavior. It's exciting, right? Or the porn just creates fantasy, right? And so then they can't, it desensitizes, right?
And then you can't perform in a normal
capacity. Absolutely.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
Yep. Because they can't ever live up to what they see on.
You need to be hanging upside down in a special outfit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Right.
Well, let's see. It's only Tuesday, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew I charged that swing on the wrong card.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting fact, too, that 17 to 37 million people suffer from sex addiction.
Is that's in the U.S.?
And it doesn't discriminate. Yep. Yeah, the DSM calls it a disorder.
So what is the impact of that, do you think? I mean, so if you've got something that is an actual disease as compared to a disorder, I mean.
Yeah. I don't even know if I know the answer.
I would think from an insurance mm-hmm. standpoint, it might mean that they would try to, you know, or try not to if, you know, if it's not a disease, but.
Can absolutely be that dynamic. Yeah.
So then how does that work and how do marriage
labels typically they usually go through pretty both of them go through pretty extensive therapy.
Okay.
And then there's what they call a full disclosure. So they'll work with two or three different counselors, so a couples counselor and then an individual counselor for each person. And the sex addict will actually disclose everything they've done. They won't go into graphic detail, but they will say, when I said I was here, I was actually here. And when you thought I was with her, I was, you know, but they don't go into the graphic. Yeah. And then the partner has the opportunity to decide, am I staying or am I going? Am I gonna trust that he's in full recovery and he's going to get the help he needs, or am I tapping out and moving on?
Yeah.
But with the love addict, if that were the person that's not the sex addict, mm-hmm. how difficult is that? Because you just keep wanting and pleasing and needing more and more and more. how does that love addict then heal themselves?
Yeah, they have to. They also have to do their own therapy. It's not. It's kind of like alcohol. It's a family dis-ease, right? And so they too have to do therapy and recovery. They do. Yeah, that's why there's SLAA for the love addicts to do their work. And what Pia Melody says is that to cure it, you have to do shame reduction. So, and that's done therapeutically. Yeah.
Can you cure it? Or is it an addiction that you're always, so when they say you're an alcoholic,
you're always an alcoholic, right? So. But if you're in recovery, you're sober. So there's sobriety for both. So there's sobriety for the sex addict, there's sobriety for the love addict, there's sobriety for the sex and love addict. So,
they just
have to stay in active recovery.
Okay. Interesting. So the one thing, the question I was going to ask was about labels, because it's like, you know, you go through different things,
right.
And it's like, you know, right now one of the labels that is a hot one is, you know, everybody's a narcissist, mm-hmm. You know.
We can do a whole 5 segments on that.
Right. Yeah. Well, they're a textbook yeah. narcissist.
Lot of times sex addicts in their addiction, like anybody in their addiction, are narcissistic, but yeah. It doesn't make them a full-blown narcissist.
Right. Well, yeah. And everybody exhibits narcissistic behavior. You have to have some of that to be able to survive.
We're all selfish, but there's very specific criteria for them to be a narcissist.
Right.
And I specialize in that as well, so we can certainly cover that topic one
day. Okay.
So we can put that as one of our top ones that we do, because I know, particularly in your field, you probably get everybody coming in saying, I'm married to a narcissist. And so, but the problem, the one way to determine it is if they're going after full custody of their kids.
Right.
Because a lot of times they'll abuse them, you know, in the court system.
Right.
And try to run them out of money so that then they can take the kids from them.
Interesting. Yeah. So the other label to go along with that, mm-hmm. Was make me think of calling someone a sex addict, because mm-hmm. you start seeing that
right.
and
just because they've had an affair doesn't make them a sex addict.
Yeah, just yeah. because exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And so,
and even if they've had multiple affairs, it doesn't make them a sex addict.
Right.
You know, if their needs were not getting met in the marriage, or you know, they just like to cheat, and doesn't necessarily. Sex addict.
Right.
If they could stop the cheating on their own, then they're not a sex addict.
Right.
Why is it that if you are a cheater, or if you have cheated before, why is it more prevalent for you to repeat that again?
Because of the excitement. It's really not so much about the cheating itself. It's the addiction to excitement. And so once somebody in a monogamous relationship has that taste of that, it's difficult to not want it again. It's kind of like sampling heroin, right? Like your gut or cocaine or whatever it is, you're going to want to do it. You're going to want to do it again.
But it becomes easier for that person to justify that because they were chasing that thrill. I mean, I'm just
a lot of times this, that's what it is, that they're chasing the. It's really not necessarily an addiction to the cheating. It's an addiction to the excitement.
I see.
That can go back to childhood too. If they came from a chaotic childhood, you know, they got very addicted to the excitement of the childhood.
Yeah.
And so they grow up and they're not a sex addict, but they, you know, may like to cheat because
they need that.
And they will add the excitement into their relationship because that's what they became addicted to as a child. Yep. They'll create their own drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let me see if this is good where I just need to press
yeah.
record.
It's so interesting. It's so actually really sad.
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
Like, I guess you can only hope not to fuck up your kid as much as you're right. going to fuck you up, right?
So exactly.
That term, right? It's very sad, but
I think we all do damage to our children unintentionally.
Yeah, right.
You know, so. Okay, you ready?
Okay.
All right. Hey, folks, Mark Scroggins and Cindy Hyde back with Family Law Talk, and we've been talking about sex addiction, love addiction, all kinds of different things. A couple of things I wanted to talk about. So red flags, okay? So what are red flags that you would want to look for or maybe that just slap you in the face that would make you think, hey, this person may be a sex addict. I need to, you know, look more closely at that.
Yeah, and so there's a really good comprehensive questionnaire on SAA.org, and I believe it's SAA, yeah. And so there's a list that if you think that you might have an issue, that you can answer some questions. And there's also a list that a partner could read to see if some of those fit. So one of the number one questions that could be a red flag is if your partner's asking you to do things that you feel really uncomfortable with. So, and they're, you know, and if they're just asking you for some unusual things in the bedroom, that's one thing. But if they're asking you to swing, for instance, and that's totally outside of your wheelhouse and it makes you feel really uncomfortable, it might be something to take a better look at or a harder look at. And, you know, another red flag would be if they're anorexic in the marriage and they're not having sex with you and they're 35, 40 years old. Well, at 35 and 40 years old, most men are, you know, wanting to have a lot of sex. So right. If they're not having sex with you, how are they getting those needs met? So that would be something to pay attention to, too. Obviously, you know, the typical if they're not, you know, coming home real late at night or, you know, they have these unexplained periods of behavior or absences that that just don't feel right. And so, you know, you want to just trust your gut. But at the same time, you know, you want to be sure that you're not just going out and accusing your spouse. I think because you're not having sex with me and you're anorexic in this marriage, you've got to be a sex addict.
Right.
Well, not everybody is.
Right.
And so it's kind of like we were talking on the break about, you know, just because someone cheats doesn't necessarily make them a sex addict.
Right.
You know, there could be a number of things going on, a lot of different dynamics going on. For instance, if maybe they're not getting their needs met in the marriage, still doesn't make it right, but it,
right.
You know, that could be one reason. You know, another reason could be that they are acting out sexually outside the relationship and not in the relationship, and so that would be something to pay attention to. But, you know, but not all cheaters are sex addicts, and that's the
right.
point I kind of want to drive home, you know, because sometimes cheating is more about an addiction to excitement than it is to the sex itself, you know, particularly if someone grew up in a really chaotic childhood or even if there was any kind of sexual molestation, you know, their little bodies at a young age could have addicted to the excitement chemicals that fire off when there's chaos and excitement. So then fast forward, grow up and get in relationships and you find yourself cheating a lot, it's probably not really about the cheating. It's probably about the excitement chemicals firing off that make, you know, that feel normal to you. And so it's kind of like, you know, once they sample the cocaine of sex, you know, outside of a relationship, you know, they're going to want another taste of that at some
right.
point. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of times you hear the term once a cheater, always a cheater. That can be true for that reason, because they get that taste for excitement and it's hard to dial that back once that happens.
Okay. Let's talk about what is out there as far as treatment if somebody has a problem. But I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned, and I can't remember if it was during the session or during the break, shame reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
So what is involved mm-hmm. with that?
Mm-hmm. And so shame reduction applies more, well, it's actually for sex addicts and love addicts, but it's used a lot more with love addicts. But that is where you do some shame reduction work with a therapist or in treatment. There's a lot of great treatment centers out there that do love addiction work. And so that's where that comes in. But also, too, for sex addicts, Patrick Carnes has written numerous workbooks and recovery tools to help sex addicts reduce their shame and also to take a hard look at the power factor that drives a sex addict, because sex addiction a lot of times is driven by power or the need for power. And so it does, and it can be from, like I said before, it can be from childhood molestation and other things. But you know, let's just look at that. If they were molested as a child, they may have made some sort of inner commitment to themselves that nobody would ever take power over them again, right? Or if they were, you know, abused in some way. So it becomes very much about power. And we see it a lot in a lot of power career professionals that, you know, have a high profile, high power job position. We'll see sex addiction show up a lot in those fields. And so there has to be shame reduction work done also with sex addicts, and that's done through either work with a therapist, recovery groups, or even therapist-led groups. So there's a lot of help out there for anybody that's struggling with that, because almost all addiction is shame-based.
So, and I want to dig into that just a little bit more. So when we're talking about shame, you're not just talking about shame related to the specific sexual action or something like that. You're talking about other areas of your life. Is
Absolutely.
That correct?
Yeah. Well, because most of the time, addiction is led by shame. So it had to start somewhere, right? And so typically it does start in family of origin. And so, you know, we go through life and we soothe in ways that help reduce the pain or numb out the pain. And so a lot of addiction is about numbing out the pain and the shame and not, you know, wanting to feel unworthy anymore or not wanting to feel unlovable or not good enough anymore. And so, you know, somebody that leans towards addiction will find a way to use something, whether it's people, whether it's a substance, to fill that void and make themselves feel better one way or the other, because the shame reduction work has never happened. And so that's really, you know, one of the best places to start is in looking at the shame that was created both in childhood and in adult life.
Okay. Since we've got a little bit of a limit on time, let's jump over to a couple of other things that are related, but a little different. So I was looking at an article. What's that? The labels. Oh, yeah. We can talk about that some.
Sure.
So one of the things we were talking about during the break is that, you know, I have people come into my office all the time and talk about, you know, my husband or my wife is a textbook narcissist. And I have also seen, and as you know, that most of the time that's bullshit. you know, so... But people want to believe that because it's a hot topic and there's plenty of stuff out there on the internet. But I'm also seeing some stuff where people are, and it's clearly a misuse on the term, you know, he or she is a sex addict or something like that. Right. And but it's used more along the lines of, instead of the standpoint of like, you know, he or she is anorexic in the relationship and, you know, and they think that, you know, cheating like nobody's tomorrow. It's, you know, the, you know, he or she won't leave me alone. It's not the even asking them to do something that they're uncomfortable with, but just a really high libido or whatever.
Very well could be.
So what kind of things do you see in that? And is there, it always seems to me it's a little dangerous when people start, you know, throwing labels around because it's a misinterpretation and it kind of minimizes what the problem is.
Yeah, and so sometimes, you know, if it is true sex addiction, for instance, you know, sometimes the addict may not even know they have an addiction until, you know, they're exposed in some way or the spouse is about to file for divorce and all of a sudden they're looking at this thing of, oh my gosh, you know, they're right, I haven't been able to stop doing this behavior. But not every cheater is a sex addict, right? That doesn't necessarily, and so, but a lot of times a spouse will come in to your office and say, I'm married to a sex addict because they've cheated 3 or 4 or 10 times or, or whatever. Not always the case. And it's best to have a professional diagnose that and not go to the internet for that type of information, because there's a lot of people out there with no letters behind their name calling things that they're not. And it's kind of the same thing with narcissism. You know, it's kind of like we were saying earlier, you know, we all have a little bit of selfishness to us, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't make any of us a full-blown narcissist. There's very specific criteria, and we could do 5 episodes on just that subject. But there's very specific criteria on whether or not somebody is a true narcissist. But what happens a lot of times is because it's out there on so many platforms, You know, it's all over Facebook. There's a dozen different groups. There's, you know, and there's all these books written by non-professionals, which I'm not knocking that. Some of them have really good information, but they're not necessarily identifying the true core behaviors that would make someone a narcissist. So, you know, before you slap those labels on people, you want to, you know, see an expert or a professional that can, you know, help you determine whether or not that is true. But I will say this, there are a lot of narcissistic people out there that may not be full-blown narcissists, and right. There are true narcissists out there, and you do have to be really careful, you know, but you want to be sure you're calling a spade, right? Because, you know, you don't want to give somebody a label that doesn't really apply. And so, but yes, sex addicts can also border on narcissism as well, but anybody in their addiction can have narcissistic behavior, whether sure. it's a substance or people, they can absolutely have that behavior in their addiction because the loyalty to their addiction is far greater than their loyalty to anything else. And so their behaviors will look like they are a full-blown narcissist when they're probably really not in sobriety. And so, you know, and that is the key in, you know, in solving a lot of this is sobriety. If somebody is truly an addict or if somebody is truly, you know, a sex addict or a love addict is getting sober.
So, I mean, in when you're dealing with drugs and alcohol, there's a difference between, you know, I think anyway, between being sober and being dry. And so I don't know, how do you quantify that over in the sex addict, love addict area? I mean, is abstinence enough or...
Yeah. And so what the goal typically is in sobriety for sex addiction is to teach healthy sexuality and to be able to have healthy sexual boundaries within the relationship. It doesn't mean you can't still have some fun and do some fun things that may not be the norm for everyone.
Right.
But it does mean that, you know, it requires partner consent and and typically in sobriety it's more about having one specific relationship that you have healthy sex in. Because so often when there's acting out behavior, there's also a lot of fantasy thinking going on. And so it takes a while and some therapy and recovery in order to start wanting to have, you know, sex within a healthy relationship.
Okay. Mira, how are we on time? Okay, so I was looking at this article. You know what? Actually, let's keep it kind of on this area because I saw something at the back of this that I wanted to talk about, that it was talking about a love drug or, you know, things like the Greeks used to talk about different things with aphrodisiacs that I always heard of, you know, oysters and different things. So, I guess the question is there such a thing? I mean, I know that one of the things I always found that was interesting, the development of the drug, you know, MDMA or ecstasy or Molly or whatever it's called now, you know, was really used in a therapeutic. And you're seeing a lot of stuff come back with different drugs where, you know, from that to psilocybin, you know, mushrooms and... God, what's the one that is so popular in South America and Central America? No, but that's another one that is being used, and that's had a huge thing, huge impact with people that have had really bad clinical depression that other antidepressants haven't met, where they've done microdosing, It's been phenomenal.
Yeah. And so, yeah, psychedelics are like the big buzzword in the therapeutic world now. And, you know, there's been a lot of, you hear, you know, the buzz on Delta 8, which I don't recommend because it is a hallucinogen and it's done without therapeutic guidance. Mm-hmm. However, but, you know, you can enhance anything with a drug.
Right.
You know, and sex is no different.
And,
you know, it's very common, and I see this a lot, where a sex addict can also have a drug problem because they're, you know, trying to, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, in addiction, you're only as good as the next high. So, like, you know, even just looking at an alcoholic, you know, they can't just go have one or two drinks anymore. They have to have two or three bottles, right?
Exactly.
Because it's never going to be enough. It's
right.
never going to be enough. So it's the same thing in sex addiction. You know, they're going to have more, and it's going to have to get more exciting because there's that addiction to excitement that also comes into play as well. And so they're going to find ways to enhance it and make the experience more, 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 to the point that they are losing their job because they're doing things at their office they shouldn't be doing, or, you know, they're destroying multiple marriages that they have because they can't seem, you know, to stop because it's never quite enough.
Right.
And so, but yeah, there's absolutely enhancing drugs for just about anything you want to do. But in the therapeutic field, what we've discovered, or what, well, I didn't discover it. I wish I had discovered it, right? But Gabor Mate kind of is the pioneer in trauma, and he did a lot of research in psychedelics and trauma and how it can actually help people really work through some old wounding, and maybe some pretty horrific wounding that they, with years of therapy, were never able to do.
Right.
And so, you know, it's just now starting to be a pretty good buzzword floating around the therapeutic community. And it is legal in some states
right.
for therapists to administer psychedelic drugs. But
Texas
we're not
being
here
one.
In Texas. No, not in Texas at this point.
And sorry to interrupt you, but if there, if someone was interested mm-hmm. in that, where can they go to find information about that? And you said you can do it in some states. I mean, what are the states that are really kind of at the forefront of that?
So I believe, and I don't know all of them, I
sure.
believe California is one of the states right now.
Okay.
But you could, in fact, Gabor Mate has a documentary, and I think it might be on Netflix or something, but you could look up the Gabor Mate trauma documentary, and it's... And it goes into some depth on what it is and why they use it.
Okay. All right. Well, folks, come back and join us here in a minute. We're going to go into a different area, which I had never heard of the term mate copying before, but I knew people that did the behavior that it's talking about. So come back and join us, and we'll go down that road a little bit.